This is the Music Halls of Fame podcast. This week, we honored the year in music for 1994, along with a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class of 1994. We also look at two more nominees for this year's class in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, plus our Spotlight Hall of Fame is the ARIA Hall of Fame in Melbourne, Australia. Before we get going with the podcast, like everyone tells you, please like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell so you'll know when these podcast episodes drop, which is usually every Thursday. Now, on to this week's episode. The year was 1994. In music, 1994 was the year that Michael Jackson married Lisa Marie Presley, Aerosmith became the first major label band to purposely put a free song onto the internet for download, and Lisa Left Eye Lopez of TLC burned down her boyfriend's mansion. Hell literally hath no fury like a woman scorned who also knows how to use a flame accelerant. Woodstock 94 happened. The three-day festival was televised on MTV and helped to put artists Nine Inch Nails, Green Day, Sheryl Crow, and Melissa Etheridge's careers all into overdrive. Pink Floyd went on tour for the final time. Pearl Jam went to war with Ticketmaster. Michael Bolton was found guilty of copyright infringement after a court found that his song, Love is a Wonderful Thing, was a little too close to the Isley Brothers song of the exact same name. Bryan Adams became the first Western music artist since the end of the Vietnam War to hold a concert in Vietnam. The United States Supreme Court ruled that parodying songs was allowed under the Fair Use Law. The ruling had to do with the Two Live Crew's use of Roy Orbison's song, Oh Pretty Woman, for a parody song without getting permission first. Bands who got together in 1994 included 20 Fingers, Basement Jacks, La Bouche, Bowling for Soup, The Derek Trucks Band, Disturbed, Death in Vegas, The Foo Fighters, The Fugees, Gravity Kills, Hoobastank, Method Man and Redman, The Lox, Limp Bizkit, Lucid Nation, Lunatic, Pendulum, Muse, Seven Dust, Sasha and John Digweed, Scarfo, The Rasmus, Republica, Rednecks, Orgy, Orbit, Orange 9mm, Space Hog, The Spice Girls, Sneaker Pimps, Sunvolt, Skunk Anansie, Storyville, System of a Down, Static X, Total, and Tenacious D. Bill Wyman left the Rolling Stones in 1994. Groups who either broke up until their inevitable reunions or announced a hiatus included Acid Test, Bob's Your Uncle, Nirvana, mainly because of Kurt Cobain's death, High Five, School of Fish, The Staple Singers, Los Bukis, Jellyfish, Con Can, Level 42, Leaders of the New School, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Dramarama, Main Source, Uncle Tupelo, Whitesnake, Winger, The Wonder Stuff, New Kids on the Block, Five Blind Boys of Mississippi, and Firehose. Groups that got back together in 1994 included the Circle Jerks, King Crimson, and Hell finally froze over and got the Eagles back together. The biggest selling song of 1994 was Ace of Base's The Sign. In fact, it was the year of Ace of Base, as the group had three of the top 10 best selling singles, with the other two songs being All That She Wants and Don't Turn Around. Other hits from 1994 included I Swear by All for One, I'll Make Love to You by Boys to Men, The Power of Love by Celine Dion, Hero by Mariah Carey, Stay by Lisa Loeb, and Breathe Again by Toni Braxton. Despite the success of Ace of Base's album The Sign, the biggest selling album of the year was actually the Lion King soundtrack. 1994 was also a year where a lot of breakthrough and landmark albums were released. Alice in Chains released their EP, Jar of Flies, which became the first EP to hit number one on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart. Green Day released their album Dookie. Nine Inch Nails released their album The Downward Spiral. The Offspring released their album Smash, which became the biggest selling independent album of all time. Weezer released their debut album. Oasis released their debut album, Definitely Maybe. The Arctic Monkeys released their debut album, and Jeff Buckley released his album Grace. Tim McGraw, Boyz II Men, The Counting Crows, Stone Temple Pilots, Kenny G, and Mariah Carey also had big-selling albums. In country music, the biggest albums included John Michael Montgomery's Kickin' It Up, Garth Brooks's The Hits, George Strait's Lead On, Tim McGraw's Not a Moment Too Soon, Mary Chapin Carpenter's Stories in the Road, Brooks and Dunn's Waitin' on Sundown. Big country singles included John Michael Montgomery's I Swear and also Be My Baby Tonight, George Strait's The Big One, Tim McGraw's Don't Take the Girl, Clay Walker's Dreaming with My Eyes Open, Travis Tritt's Foolish Pride, Clint Black's A Good Run of Bad Luck, Mark Chestnut's I Just Wanted You to Know, and Shenandoah's If Bubba Can Dance, I Can Too. In hip-hop, there were classic albums like Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die, Nas's Illmatic, Jeru the Damages' The Sun Rises in the East, Pete Rock and C.L. Smooth's The Main Ingredient, Organized Confusion's Stress the Extinction Agenda, Snoop Dogg's Murder Was the Case, Warren G.'s Regulate G-Funk Era, Method Man's Tykel, Bone Thugs and Harmony's Creepin' on a Come Up, Gangstar's Hard to Earn, Digable Planet's Blowout, Comb, Scarface's The Diary, Gravedigga's 6 Feet Deep, and Outkast's Southern Playlist Cadillac Music. Some of the popular hip-hop songs were Warren G's Regulate, Coolio's Fantastic Voyage, Heavy D's Nothing But Love, and also Got Me Waiting, Salt-N-Pepa and En Vogue's What a Man, Snoop Dogg's Gin and Juice, and also Who Am I, Craig Mack's Flavor in Your Ear, Tupac's Keep Your Head Up, Bone Thugs and Harmony's Thuggish Ruggish Bone, and Notorious B.I.G.'s Juicy. In dance music, DJ Paul Oakenfold broadcasted his first legendary Goa mix. Mix Mag started a trend when they anointed Sasha as the first superstar DJ. The label would soon be applied to a number of festival headlining DJs after that. The record label Metalhead, started by DJs Chemistry, Storm, and Goldie, helped to put drum and bass onto the genre map. Orbital performed an iconic performance at the Glastonbury Music Festival that helped to bring EDM to a more mainstream audience at that time. Great Britain passed the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, which tried to punish rave culture. Ravers responded, of course, by protesting and raving, although they did have one sanctioned rave at Wembley Stadium that drew 10,000 people. Cafe Mambo and the Cream Parties also started in Ibiza that year. Some of the big dance albums that were popular in 1994 included Massive Attack's Protection, Portishead's Dummy, The Prodigy's Music for the Jilted Generation, which had the hit songs Voodoo People and No Good, Paul Van Dyke's 45 RPM, which had the very influential song For an Angel. Other classic dance tracks that were big that year included Livin' Joy's Dreamer, Reel to Reel's I Like to Move It, Move It, 20 Fingers' Short Short Man, which is the censored version of their song Short D Man. You could probably figure out what the D is. Two Unlimited's Let the Beat Control Your Body, Real McCoy's Runaway, and also their hit Another Night, M People's Moving On Up, Crystal Waters' 100% Pure Love, General Public's I'll Take You There, and Gloria Estefan's Turn the Beat Around. The first DJ Mag Top 100 DJs list didn't officially start getting announced until 1997, although DJ Mag did name Danny Rampling as the best DJ of the year, without actually saying who else made the list. In Latin music, the biggest artists included Gloria Estefan, Luis Miguel, The Gypsy Kings, Selena, Maná, Bronco, Marco Antonio Solis in Los Bucas, La Mafia, Ana Gabriel, and John Secada. Musicals and revivals of musicals that opened on Broadway included Beauty and the Beast, Carousel, Damn Yankees, Grease, Showboat, and Sunset Boulevard. Musical movies that came out in 1994 included Airheads, Backbeat, Fear of a Black Hat, Immortal Beloved, Hated, G.G. Allen and the Murder Junkies, The Lion King, The Swan Princess, and Thumbelina. Artists who were born in 1994 included Justin Bieber, Harry Styles, Bad Bunny, Maluma, Ashton Irwin of 5 Seconds of Summer, Howard Lawrence of Disclosure, DJ Nathan Daw, DJ Madeon, Phoebe Bridgers, Kaliuchis, Christina Grimmie, Ava Max, Kai of EXO, RM and J-Hope of BTS, Lin Gunn of Paris, Halsey, rappers King Von, Dax, Dreezy, and Lil Baby. Artists who passed away in 1994 included Kurt Cobain of Nirvana, who committed suicide, singer-songwriter Harry Nilsson, composer Henry Mancini, songwriter Jules Stein, entertainers Donald Swan of Flanders and Swan, Martha Ray, and Dinah Shore. Also, guitarist Fred Sonic Smith of MC5, bassist Kristen Pfaff of Hole, singers Ephraim Lewis, Garnett Silk, and Dan Hartman, jazz guitarists Eric Gale and Joe Pass, and jazz singers Carmen McRae and Cab Calloway. In awards for the music of 1994, at the Grammy Awards, Sheryl Crow won Best New Artist and also Record of the Year for All I Wanna Do, while Bruce Springsteen won Song of the Year for Streets of Philadelphia. Also, Tony Bennett's MTV Unplugged album won Best Album of the Year. At the American Music Awards, Michael Bolton, Mariah Carey, Ace of Base, and the Lion King soundtrack were the big winners. At the Billboard Music Awards, Ace of Base won Artist of the Year. At the MTV Video Music Awards, Video of the Year went to Aerosmith for the song Cryin'. Queen Latifah won Entertainer of the Year at the Soul Train Music Awards. Reba McEntire, Aerosmith, and Garth Brooks won the music categories at the People's Choice Awards. At the Eurovision Singing Contest that was held in Dublin, Ireland that year, the country of Ireland won for the song Rock and Roll Kids. It was done by Paul Harrington and Charlie McGettigan. Vince Gill won Entertainer of the Year at the Country Music Association Awards, and Reba McEntire won Entertainer of the Year at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Blur won Best British Album for Park Life, and Blur also won Best Song for Park Life at the Brit Awards. Celine Dion won Best Album of the Year for Color of My Love, while Jan Arden won Best Song of the Year for I Could Be Your Girl at the Juno Awards. Tina Arena won Album of the Year for Don't Ask, and Silverchair won Single of the Year for Tomorrow at the ARIA Music Awards. At the Tony Awards, Passion won Best Musical. 1994 was also the first year that the Tonys gave out an award for Best Revival of a Musical, which was won that year by Carousel. Before then, plays and musicals went up in the same category called Best Revival. The Pulitzer Prize for Music was won by Gunther Schuller for Of Reminiscences and Reflections. Musically, at the Academy Awards, the movie The Lion King won both music categories, with Elton John and Tim Rice's Can You Feel the Love Tonight winning Best Song and Hans Zimmer winning for Best Original Score. M People won the Mercury Music Prize for the album Elegant Slumming. The 1994 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony was held on January 19th at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. At the ceremony, Bono gave one of the best introduction speeches ever for inductee Bob Marley. Paul McCartney hugged Yoko Ono during John Lennon's induction. There was supposed to be a reunion of the group The Band, but some feuds still run deep, and the one between band members Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm ran rivers deep at that point. They eventually reconciled a decade later after 35 years of not talking to each other. During the rest of the ceremony, band leader, talent scout, and record producer Johnny Otis was inducted into the non-performers category. Willie Dixon was inducted into the Early Influencers category, and in the Performers category, the Hall inducted The Animals, The Band, Duane Eddy, The Grateful Dead, Sir Rod Stewart, Elton John, John Lennon, and this next artist. Bob Marley was born on February 6, 1945, to a younger black Jamaican mother and a much older white British military captain. I only mention both the age gap and the races because supposedly either of those factors, or perhaps even both of them, caused an awful lot of family tension, so Bob's father left the family shortly after his birth. Raised primarily in 9 Mile, St. Anne's Parish, Bob's mother gave him a life that was grounded in Jamaican traditions, as 9 Mile offered a very peaceful environment. Bob spent his days playing in the fields, learning about agriculture from his grandfather, Omaria, who was a respected Mile man, or healer, as it's known in Jamaica, with knowledge of African herbal traditions. This early exposure to African spirituality would later influence Bob's Rastafari beliefs. Music was always in Bob's life. He learned to play guitar from his friend Neville Bunny Wailer Livingston, and together they explored their musical talents. The Jamaican folk style Mento, together with their listening to American R&B radio stations that they could get in on their radio, influenced their music later on. In 1957, at the age of 12, Bob and his mother moved from 9 Mile to Kingston, which is Jamaica's capital. They were both looking for better economic opportunities. However, they ended up living in Trenchtown, a notoriously impoverished and overcrowded neighborhood. And this harsh reality shaped Bob's worldview and fueled his desire for a better future. Living in Trenchtown exposed Bob to extreme poverty, gang violence, and social injustice. Sound systems, mobile DJs playing the latest Jamaican music on powerful speakers, became social hubs in the neighborhood. Bob and Bunny, along with their friend Junior Braithwaite, formed a vocal trio at the time called the Wailing Wailers, influenced by the soulful sounds of American doo-wop and Jamaican ska. The group added Peter Tosh, Beverly Kelso, and Cherry Smith to become the Wailers. Ska, which is a fast-paced, upbeat style with a lot of piano and guitar in it, dominated the Jamaican music scene in the late 1950s. The Wailers, still teenagers at the time, auditioned for a lot of record producers like Leslie Kong and Coxon Todd, and they finally ended up getting to record. Their early recordings reflected the ska style, but the trio put their own spin on the style with lyrics tackling themes of poverty, love, and social issues. By the early 1960s, the ska trend in Jamaica started to change over to rocksteady, which is a slower, more soulful variation. The Wailers switched their sound to rocksteady, but success was kind of elusive for them at the time. Sometimes you just can't chase a trend. The group faced a lot of financial hardship, recording for small labels and a lot of limited radio airplay. But despite their struggles, their raw talent and Marley's charismatic vocals did begin to attract attention. And finally, their efforts paid off in 1963 when Clement Coxon Dodd, who was the owner of Studio One, finally gave them a full recording session. The resulting album, aptly titled The Wailing Wailers, was released in 1965 and showcased their early ska and rocksteady influences. While it wasn't a commercial smash, it did contain songs like Simmer Down, a plea for peace amidst gang violence, that resonated with the Jamaican youth of that era. This track became their first major local hit, also establishing them as rising stars in the period. The Wailers continued recording for Studio One, experimenting with new sounds and themes. A pivotal moment came in 1965 with the release of the single One Love, a reworked version of Curtis Mayfield's People Get Ready. This soulful ballad, with its message of love and unity, transcended social barriers and became a national anthem of sorts in Jamaica. Their growing popularity landed them gigs across the island, solidifying their place in the Jamaican music scene. During this period, Bob Marley, along with Bunny Wailer and Peter Tosh, embraced Rastafarianism, a religious movement at the time that emerged in Jamaica in the early 20th century. Rastafari offered a spiritual identity for Jamaicans of African descent, promoting themes of pan-Africanism, black liberation, and repatriation to Africa. Bob's spirituality deepened, influencing his songwriting style and also introducing themes of social justice, Jah, which is what they called God, and resistance. The influence of Rastafari became evident in their music. Songs like How Many Times and Put It On incorporated Rastafarian ideas of oppression and redemption. Their songs started to evolve, incorporating slower tempos, a lot of prominent bass lines, and the distinctive skank rhythm that would become synonymous with reggae. Bob met Rita Anderson, who later became his wife Rita Marley, in the early 1960s. They married in 66. Rita became a constant source of support, not only as his wife, but also as an eventual backup vocalist for the Wailers. A very crucial turning point came in 1972 when the Wailers signed with Island Records, a British label at the time owned by Chris Blackwell. Blackwell recognized the potential of reggae and Bob Marley's unique voice, and this partnership would propel Bob Marley and the Wailers to international stardom. This period witnessed the Wailers' evolution from a local ska group to becoming one of the pioneers of reggae. Their music became infused with Rastafarian ideology, reflecting the themes of social justice and Pan-Africanism. And while internal conflicts led to lineup changes, Bob Marley's unwavering dedication and the support of Rita Marley and Chris Blackwell set the stage for all the global success. The album Catch a Fire, produced by Chris Blackwell, marked the Wailers' international debut. Blackwell introduced rock and roll elements to their sound, expanding their appeal beyond reggae purists. Songs like Concrete Jungle and Stir It Up address social issues and Rastafarian themes, resonating with the global audience. Catch a Fire became a critical and commercial success, establishing Bob Marley and the Wailers as an upcoming force in the music industry. Riding the momentum of Catch a Fire, the Wailers released Burnin' later in 1973. This album cemented their status as reggae icons. Get Up, Stand Up, a powerful call for social justice, became an anthem for the oppressed worldwide. Burnin' also featured the iconic song I Shot the Sheriff, which was later redone by Eric Clapton. These albums showcase the perfect blend of reggae rhythms, Bob's soulful vocals, and politically charged lyrics, capturing the hearts and minds of the audience. But despite their new success, financial constraints were a constant source of tension. Unequal pay distribution and a lack of control over royalties caused friction within the group. Bob's charisma and songwriting naturally placed him at the forefront of the group. But this shift in power dynamics created a lot of resentment, particularly for Peter Tosh, who also harbored leadership aspirations of the group. This all came to a boil in the mid-1970s. Bunny Wailer, seeking greater artistic control and being frustrated by all those financial issues with Island Records head Chris Blackwell, left the Wailers to pursue a solo career. This actually ended up being a significant loss, as Wailer's harmonies and his songwriting talents were integral to the group's sound. Shortly after Wailer's departure, Peter Tosh's clashes with Bob Marley over musical direction and the band's leadership escalated. Tosh felt Bob was steering the band away from their roots towards a more commercial sound, and his frustration culminated in his departure in 1974, leaving Bob Marley as the undisputed leader of the group now. Bob, though, remained committed to the music. He just ended up forming a new lineup with recruits including Rita Marley, his wife, along with new backing singers. This new lineup became known as Bob Marley and the Wailers, the group you now know today. And while they were all talented musicians, they lacked the long-standing camaraderie and the creative spark of the original group back when they had Bunny Wailer and Peter Tosh. Throughout the 1970s, Jamaica was plagued by political violence between rival political parties, the PNP, the People's National Party, and the JLP, which is the Jamaica Labor Party. Bob Marley, despite his Rastafarian beliefs in nonviolence, found himself caught up in the middle of this whole thing as both parties attempted to use his popularity for political gain. In an attempt to promote unity and reconciliation, Bob Marley organized the historic One Love Peace Concert, which was held in 1978. The concert brought together the leaders of both political parties on stage, a very significant symbolic gesture in a nation divided by violence. And while the concert didn't completely quell the political unrest, it stood as a powerful testament to Bob Marley's commitment to peace and social justice. Unfortunately for Bob, it also caused violence in his own life. On December 3, 1976, just before the concert was to take place, gunmen broke into Bob's home and attempted to kill him. Bob received minor wounds, but his wife Rita and the group's manager Don Taylor received serious wounds. Bob still ended up playing at the concert, but he was backed up by the local band Zap Pow, as the rest of the Wailers had gone into hiding because of the violence. After the concert, Bob himself left Jamaica for both the Bahamas and then eventually England, staying away from his homeland for 2.5 years. Bob wasn't the only member of the band who had to deal with all the violence. On June 9, 1999, Junior Braithwaite, along with musician Shaka, were killed in a home invasion when gunmen entered Shaka's home. On September 11, 1987, Peter Tosh's home was invaded by 3 gunmen who tortured him trying to extort money out of him. Peter had several people in the house at the time, and one of the men was someone that Peter had tried to actually help out in the past. When Peter told the gunmen that he didn't have any money, even after all the torture, the gunmen became frustrated and began shooting. Peter Tosh was shot twice in the head and died. He was 42 years old at the time. His friend, who led the gunmen, blamed it on a night of drinking. But still, he was found guilty and was later executed. In 1977, Bob Marley and the Wailers released Exodus, considered their magnum opus. The album explored themes of love, loss, and liberation, and tracks like Redemption Song and Waiting in Vain showcased Bob's introspective songwriting and soulful vocals. Exodus topped the reggae charts in the UK and received widespread critical acclaim, further solidifying Bob Marley's global superstar status. 1978's album Kaya offered a lighter, more relaxed vibe compared to Exodus, focusing on themes of love and marijuana use. The album resonated with a specific audience, but wasn't as commercially successful. Despite all of this, though, Bob Marley and the Wailers still embarked on relentless touring. In 1977, Bob noticed a dark spot developing under his big toenail. Initially, he dismissed it as a soccer injury, a sport he absolutely loved to play and would play at any given moment, even during touring. However, upon closer inspection, a doctor in 1978 diagnosed him with acral lentiginous melanoma, which is a rare and very aggressive form of skin cancer. He continued to perform for a few more years, with his final concert taking place in Pittsburgh in 1980. Despite his declining health, he still remained committed to playing his music and getting his message out there. The standard treatment for acral lentiginous melanoma is surgical removal of the affected area. In Bob Marley's case, that would have likely involved amputating his toe. Deeply rooted in Rastafarian beliefs, though, Bob Marley was hesitant about amputation, which he viewed as a mutilation of the body. He opted for a less invasive excision surgery with only the nail and the surrounding tissue being removed. Unfortunately, this approach didn't actually address the potential spread of all the cancer cells. Bob sought alternative treatments, including exercise, vitamins, and even ozone therapy, in the hopes of curing his cancer. And while these approaches may offer some general health benefits, they actually still haven't been proven effective in treating melanoma. Bob Marley's continued reliance on alternative therapies and his refusal for further conventional medical treatment allowed all that cancer to finally spread. By 1980, his health had deteriorated significantly. Still, he and his band forged on and embarked on a tour in support of their album Uprising. They played two shows at Madison Square Garden in New York City. But while jogging in Central Park during a morning off from the New York City concerts, Bob collapsed and he was rushed to the hospital. And it was there where doctors discovered that the cancer had spread to his lungs, brain, and liver. He played his final concert at the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on September 23, 1980. After that, the group canceled the rest of their tour dates while Bob went on a final attempt at alternative treatment in Germany. Sadly, his health continued to decline, forcing him to return to Jamaica. Tragically, he never made it alive to Jamaica. His condition became critical during a flight from Germany to Jamaica, and the plane was diverted to Miami, Florida. Upon landing in Miami, Bob was rushed to the hospital. His final words were reportedly to his son Ziggy Marley, who had met him at the hospital. The words, quote, "On your way up, take me up. On your way down, don't let me down," end quote. Bob Marley was pronounced dead on May 11, 1981. He was only 36 years old at the time. On May 21, 1981, Bob was given a state funeral. He was buried near his birthplace in Nine Mile. In his casket was his legendary Red Gibson Les Paul guitar and a Bible open to Psalm 23. That's the verse known as the Lord's Prayer. "The Lord is my shepherd," etc., etc. The casket also has a stock of ganja that his widow Rita put in there because, well, you gotta have something while you're up there. Why not? There remains some speculation as to whether Bob would have survived with an earlier diagnosis and the rather conventional treatment. Regardless, his death does serve as a reminder of the importance of early detection and treatment for melanoma, along with other forms of skin cancer, especially among people of color. While acral-lentiginous melanoma is less common than other forms, it is still crucial to pay attention to any changes in your skin pigmentation. As far as the Wailers went, the group released a posthumous album, Confrontation, in 1983. In 1984, the group's greatest hits album, Legend, was released. Legend remains the best-selling reggae album of all time to this very day, and is probably, more than probably, the only reggae album that people who swear that they love reggae music actually own or even know about. Of course, Bob's influence on music is immeasurable, as he is credited with being the one who brought reggae to the world in general, although reggae artists like Jimmy Cliff helped that out as well, especially with Jimmy's movie The Harder They Come being out at that time. Groups like The Police took reggae and mixed it with other sounds to create their style, while ska music took over Great Britain, first in the 60s and then again in full in the 1980s. Bob's message, of course, of peace and revolution still resonates to this day, as his song Get Up, Stand Up literally gets played at every single rally, while One Love, unfortunately, has become a commercial theme song for beach resorts and the Jamaican Tourist Board, because I'm pretty sure that's what Bob was going for when he wrote it. Go figure. Greedy bastards. When Bob was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he was inducted by himself and without any of the other members of the Wailers, much like Bruce Springsteen was inducted by himself at first without the E Street Band. The induction should honestly read Bob Marley and the Wailers. In Springsteen's case, at least, the E Street Band was inducted some years later. I think it's time for the Wailers to finally be inducted as well. Presented for induction by Bono of 2005 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees U2, Bob Marley, without the Wailers. Inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, class of 1994, and we have put Legend, along with a few other songs, onto this week's music podcast playlist, the link to which is in the show notes. Music. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you that there is now a Music History in Depth podcast where we go more in depth on a few of the events that happened in music history for that particular week. The Music History in Depth podcast drops every Tuesday on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast from, as does our Music History Today podcast, which goes over the daily events in music history. The Music History Today podcast drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame released its nominees for the Performers category for this year's induction into the next class for the Hall. This list, however, does not include whoever they decide will be inducted into the other categories like Musical Excellence or Early Influencer because those categories haven't been decided yet. This list, though, is as follows. Mary J. Blige, Mariah Carey, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Eric B. and Rakim, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Jane's Addiction, Kool and the Gang, Lenny Kravitz, Oasis, Sinead O'Connor, Ozzy Osbourne, Sade, and A Tribe Called Quest. It's actually a pretty good list. The good news is that you get to vote for who gets inducted this year, as the fan vote is always a small but pivotal part of the total vote. Go to rockhall.com to vote. That's rockhall.com. We will put that link in the show notes for you. You can vote for up to 7 artists once a day, every single day through April 26th. For the next month, we're going to make the case for you to vote for an artist to be inducted. Check some of the earlier podcasts, as we've actually been doing this now for at least a good 4 or 5 weeks. We look at least 2 artists per episode until we get through this list. We are now down to 5 artists left. So this week, we are going to knock off 2 more. And we're going to do it by talking about Lenny Kravitz and Foreigner. To the tail of the tape we go. First off, with Lenny Kravitz. Lenny has released 11 studio albums and counting, since he also has a new album that's about to drop, along with 3 live albums, 5 compilation albums, 6 soundtrack albums, and 2 EPs. Of those, 10 have hit the top 40, with 3 of those 10 going top 10, with his highest charting album being his Greatest Hits album at number 2. Lenny has also released 61 singles. Of those, only 5 officially hit the top 40, with 2 of those 5 going to the top 10. The one thing that you realize in looking at the charts is that a lot of the songs that you figured would have charted either weren't officially released in America or were only hits on the rock charts. Songs like Are You Gonna Go My Way, for instance. Lenny has also won multiple awards like the Grammys, the Brit Awards, the American Music Awards, and the MTV Video Music Awards. Lenny has well-known songs like Always on the Run, American Woman, Fly Away, Let Love Rule to go along with, of course, Are You Gonna Go My Way. Foreigner, meanwhile, has released 9 studio albums, 7 live albums, and 20 compilation albums. Of those, 8 have hit the top 40, with 6 of those 8 hitting the top 10, with 1981's album 4 going to number 1. They also released 47 singles. Of those, 16 hit the top 40, with 9 of those 16 hitting the top 10, with 1984's Grammy Award-winning I Want to Know What Love Is being their only number 1 hit. They've had hits like Urgent, Jukebox Hero, Feels Like the First Time, Cold as Ice, Hot-Blooded, and Double Vision. All of those songs are classic rock staples these days. The problem that both Lenny and Foreigner have comes in the influence portion of their collective resumes. As popular as both artists are, and as huge a fan base as both artists have, you'll actually be hard-pressed to find a lot of other artists who have patterned their music after them. Still, both Lenny and Foreigner have songs that are in the music fabric of this country, so that has to count for something, I guess. You decide. Should they actually be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Thankfully, you can decide. Just go to rockhall.com to vote. You can vote for up to 7 artists once a day, every single day through April 26th. And to help you decide, we're going to put both of the artists' greatest hits albums onto this week's podcast playlist as well. The link, as I've said before, is in the show notes. The Arts Centre of Melbourne is a performing arts complex in the Melbourne Arts Precinct in Southbank, which is a suburb of Melbourne in Victoria, Australia. The centre was constructed starting in 1973 and completed in 1984 when it fully opened. The centre has a bunch of theatres and galleries and is noted for having not only the usual highbrow concerts and ballets from classical and jazz artists that you would expect, but they also have roller skating, also a circus and a movie theater, of all things. In the complex lies an exhibit for the ARIA Hall of Fame. ARIA, or Australian Recording Industry Association, is the Australian lobbying group for their music industry, and they're the ones who put on the ARIA Music Awards, which is their version of the Grammy Awards. They also induct people into their music halls of fame, simply called the ARIA Hall of Fame. The inductions started in 1988 and have been going on ever since, except for 2000, when no one was inducted for whatever reason. The number of annual inductees varies. For the past few years, only one act per year has been inducted. Go to artcentremelbourne.com.au for information on when the organization does their yearly exhibit and what the times of operation are. As always, check their website for hours of operation if you'd like to go, or just check out their website to see who's actually been inducted. It's actually a pretty good website. We'll put the link to the website in the show notes for you. Olivia Newton-John was born in England in 1948, but moved to Australia when she was younger. Her lineage is rather impressive. One of her grandfathers fled Hitler's Germany and won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Her great-grandfather and great-great-grandfathers were both judges. Her father worked for England's MI5 and was one of the people who apprehended Nazi Rudolf Hess. Olivia's career started when she was 14, when she was in a girl group. It didn't last too long, but it did get her spots on TV shows and also connections, including meeting future friend and collaborator Pat Carroll. During one of those shows, Olivia won a trip to England to record. She didn't want to go because she had a boyfriend in Australia, but was eventually talked into going by her mother. Once she was in England, she didn't want to stay. She was lonely. She missed her boyfriend. Tried coming back to Australia a few times, but her mom, as always, thwarted those plans, determined that her daughter was going to try and see things through and probably also to get her away from her boyfriend, who she might not liked. You know how mothers can get sometimes. Anyway, it did help for a little while that Pat Carroll also moved to England on a work visa. Olivia worked with famed producer Don Kirshner for a time in a group called Tomorrow, but that group didn't gain any attraction either. In 1971, Olivia recorded her debut album, If Not For You. The title track was a big hit for her internationally. She came out swinging right out the gate. While other songs on that album became big hits overseas, they weren't really big in America. She finally broke through in America in 1973 with the song Let Me Be There, which went top 5 in 3 different Billboard music charts, including the country music chart. She also was nominated for and won the Grammy Award for Best Country Single by a female for the song. Olivia ended up representing England in the Eurovision Song Contest, but lost that year to ABBA's Waterloo, which actually made ABBA into a worldwide sensation and got their career going. She did end up getting an album deal with EMI Records out of it, which proved very fortuitous. The album If You Love Me, Let Me Know had the title track go top 5 on the Hot 100 Singles chart and also the country chart. The next song, I Honestly Love You, also became a big hit and won her 2 Grammy Awards, including Record of the Year. At this point, Olivia started to receive some backlash from the country music community, who did not like the fact that someone who wasn't from America was finding success in their genre and winning their major awards on top of it all. It got to the point where other artists like Dolly Parton's sister had to defend her. It also led to her moving to America in order to record her next album, Have You Ever Been Mellow? The title track from that album was a huge hit, as was the next single, Please Mr. Please. Her string of hits cooled off, but not for too long. During this period, she did her own TV show, and then Hollywood came calling. Olivia starred in the movie version of the Broadway musical Grease. Fun fact, Carrie Fisher of Star Wars fame was actually up for the role of Sandy for that movie. Star Wars pretty much killed the idea. Grease not only became a huge hit, but the soundtrack became one of the biggest selling soundtracks of all time. As far as Olivia's contributions to the soundtrack, she got three top five songs out of it. You're the One That I Want and Summer Night, both with co-star John Travolta, along with Hopelessly Devoted to You. As the 1980s rolled around, Olivia began to tire of her good girl, goody two-shoes image and decided to make it a little sexier and more mature. She starred in the movie Xanadu, which didn't do too well, but the soundtrack did very well, giving her the hits Xanadu, Magic, and Suddenly. She started out the decade with the mega-successful and extremely controversial song Physical. The song was controversial because of the subject matter and heavy innuendo, which was okay for male rock artists to do, but not for female pop artists, I guess. The music video was also controversial because it had two men in it who were holding hands and looking at each other. Both the song and the music video were banned in certain places, and in spite of the bans, or maybe even because of them, the song became the biggest selling single of the 1980s. Fun fact on that one as well. The guitar solo on Physical was performed by Steve Lukather of Toto, who was on a ton of songs from the 1970s and 80s that you may not actually realize, along with having hits with his own group Toto, because at the time Steve Lukather was also a session guitarist. Another attempt to change her image was during the release of her album Soul Kiss. On the back of the album, she put a photo of herself taken from behind with herself topless, wearing tight equestrian horse riding pants and holding a riding crop. For the 1980s, and especially for Olivia's fans, that was pretty spicy and also extremely controversial. And if you think that cancel culture is something brand new, no, they tried to even cancel Olivia at that time as well. Her singing career cooled off again in the mid-1980s as other endeavors took over. She became an entrepreneur with her friend again, Miss Pat Carroll. She also became a UNICEF spokesperson, a wildlife advocate, and a cancer spokesperson, having fought a battle with breast cancer around that time. She acted occasionally, including on the TV show Glee, along with being a guest judge on RuPaul's Drag Race. She also had a number one hit on the Billboard dance charts in 2015 with a dance version of Magic, this time as a duet with her daughter Chloe. This new version hit the top of the dance charts, giving Olivia a rarity of having a mother-daughter chart-topping song. Olivia ended up losing her second battle with cancer on August 8, 2022, after having it come back in 2017 when the breast cancer that she originally had 25 years earlier beaten ended up spreading to her lower back. There have been many articles written about her that stated that the movie Grease made her a star. That's not even true. She was already a star with a bunch of hit songs and awards by then. Grease made her a superstar, and then the song Physical took her to an even higher level. You can tell that the people who wrote those articles weren't actually over the age of 40. Otherwise, they would have known, or might have done a Google search. Olivia had two number one albums, five number one singles, countless other hits that didn't even make it to number one, and four Grammy Award wins, and also a lot of country music awards. She sold over 100 million records worldwide, making her one of the biggest-selling artists of all time, male or female. Olivia Newton-John, inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame in 2002, and we are going to put a selection of her hits onto this week's music podcast playlist. The link, as I've already said a couple of times, is in the show notes. The Music Halls of Fame podcast is part of the Music History Today Network, which can be found under Music History Today on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts from, and also on our YouTube page under Music History Today. Thank you very much for listening.